The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
We are going to step into our interview with a lovely young lady who's already here via Zoom, Ms. Sharma Taylor. Good morning to you and welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM. How are you doing?
I am awesome. Good morning. Good morning. This is such a pleasure for me. I'm so excited to be with you. I'm looking forward to our time together. And special shout out to my friend Kevin George of Tropical Literature Creatives, who made the link and made this happen.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Ms. Sharma. Tell me how you started thinking about writing. What's your history?
Okay, well, I'm Jamaican, as you probably can tell from my accent. Grew up in Jamaica. I've lived in Barbados. I see myself as a Caribbean person at heart. And also probably a secret Trini, because I love Trini food. And if I'm in Trinidad, like, I just binge eat everything, especially roti. But I started out, I'm a lawyer by profession, a corporate lawyer, but I have always loved writing. Ever since I was a kid, it was my escape. It was the thing I loved to do and the thing that I felt that I did better than most other things. But instead of pursuing my passion and, you know, doing a degree in writing or English, I went to law school, became a corporate lawyer. And just later in life, I would say, went back to the love of writing. So in 2022, I published my debut novel, What a Mother's Love Don't Teach You, out of England with a press called Virago Press. But it really started in Trinidad in terms of the initial outline being given a prize at Bocas Lit Fest for emerging writers. So that is what helped me to get the support to be able to finish that book.
And briefly tell us about the book and what message you would like to send, you know, via the novel.
Okay, so the novel is, as I said, What a Mother's Love Don't Teach You. And it's set in Jamaica in the mid to early 1980s. Now, that's around my time of when I was born. And it's a historical fiction. And it centers around a lady called Dinah, who is a domestic worker helper. And 18 years before the story opens, she's a teen mom. She gets pregnant for her childhood boyfriend, and she's working for an American couple living in Jamaica who are childless, the Steels. And at the time, she thought it was a, you know, good idea to give the child a better life. They wanted to take the child, adopt the child. She agreed to that informal adoption, and they promised her that they would keep in touch. So they actually left Jamaica, but said, don't worry, we're going to write. We'll be in touch with you so you know how the baby is doing. Who she names, Dinah names Sun Sun. Unfortunately, they don't come back to the island. She never moves on. The boyfriend dumps her. She never has any other children or any other significant relationship. So she remains kind of stuck. So 18 years later, she's working for a Jamaican family now who are hosting their American friends from overseas. And the day that the novel opens would have been the 18th birthday of her long-lost son, Son. So when she goes to work that morning and the American couple's son Apollo walks into the room, Dinah is convinced that this boy is her long lost son that she had given up and has come back into her life. So the novel just explores the consequences of that meeting, the ramifications of that for everybody involved. And it's set also in a time where Dinah's living in what we call in Jamaica a garrison community. So, you know, the era Don or the era leader is also very interested in her son as well, and what she hope the length she will go to protect him as well.
So do you think that the themes that are put forward in the book are still relevant as it was in the 80s today? Have we learned anything?
Well, I love that question. That's a great question. So yes, I do think so, because although I've set it in Jamaica again, it's not a Jamaican story. Yes, I've set it against the backdrop of a time of political violence between the two major political parties and crime and all of that. But the heart of the story is, what is family? Who do you consider family? How do you choose your family? You know, and the whole thing about loss and belonging and identity. Apollo is trying to find himself as who he is as a black man in America, where he grew up in a kind of white community. His stepfather is white and all of that. So it's really around finding out who you are and also how far you're willing to go to convince yourself of what you've chosen to believe, you know, because one of the things that I third throughout the book is he her son? Is he not her son? And sort of going along that journey, the reader will try to figure out the mystery of what the situation really is.
And then you talk about life in America as it pertains to Caribbean migrants and the adapting to American culture and also holding on to identity. Is that expressed within the book as well?
Well, Apollo, as he is told, he grows up in an African-American community because his parents have not said he's adopted. And again, I'll leave that there as to whether or not he really is.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would say is that Apollo wants to identify with Jamaica. When he comes here for summer, he's here doing an internship at a law firm in Jamaica because he wants to be a lawyer. And he wants to identify with Jamaicans because he doesn't feel a sense of identity as a black man in America. Because again, he's, although growing up in a wealthy white community, he's still a black man. You know, he takes his stepfather's car one night and the police stop him and arrest him. And it's only when they realize the connection, then, you know, there's an apology or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But he comes to a country like Jamaica where you see a majority of black people in power, in powerful positions in society, and it's a departure for him. So I know normally the immigrant experience is going the other way. In the book, it's explored where a number of the characters, their parents and so migrate and they become burial children, you know, they get the Irish spring and the soap and the cornflakes and the rice and the barrel that comes down. So that aspect of it is also explored on the other end because Dinah is also surrogate mother to a young man called Dinah who lives in her community. And his mother disappeared when he was like very young and left Dinah to really care for him. And, you know, so the novel also explores a lot about the absence of a parent, the primary parent, a mother, a father, and how you adjust to that. So yeah, it's a reflection of the Caribbean experience of migrating for a better life, and on the two sides. Mm-hmm.
So from your experience going into a little bit of, you were a judge in 2022 and 2024 at the Queen's Commonwealth Essay Competition organized by the Royal Commonwealth Society, the 2023 Brooklyn Caribbean Literary Festival, the BCLF Short Fiction Story Contest for Writers in the Caribbean, and believe it's so many others that you list as well. And coming back to Trinidad, the 2023 Bocas Lit Fest, you were also part of that fellowship. In terms of Caribbean writers, how far have we come from the initial breakthrough, I would say, of Caribbean writers telling different stories? How has your journey been, and is there anything that we should improve on?
Well, that's a great question. I think we've come a far, far, far way. And we've done it on the backs of trailblazers like Earl Lovelace, of Derek Walcott, of Olive Senior, like preeminent writers from all over the Caribbean who've made their mark, so that contemporary ones today can really have our voice be heard. The publishing environment is a lot different now. I think there is more access because I think the world is hungry for a Caribbean voice, to hear a Caribbean story. So I think there's a greater appetite for our work now. I think it's a great time to be a Caribbean writer. There's still, you know, as in every industry, competition, but I also believe that cream always rises to the top. So for me as a writer, it's places like Bocas Lit Fest, for example, that you know, invest in emerging writers. I have been a beneficiary of that. You know, in Barbados, the National Cultural Foundation, they invest in competitions as well as coaching and writing sessions for emerging writers. I've been the beneficiary of that. In Jamaica, the Jamaica Cultural Development Commission, JCDC, competition, I've been a beneficiary of that. So I do think we have it in the major countries, but we need probably to shine a light on the smaller Caribbean islands with less resources. I do think that, you know, there's more that could be done in terms of government support for the creative industries. I think it's a big untapped market. I think we focus out on tourism, to some degree music, but I think people don't realize the potential of writers and in terms of what it can mean for Caribbean economies and the GDP. Like, if you could have Caribbean writers, our work becoming movies, you know, becoming TV series, things like that, it can even feed into other industries. So I think there needs to be more development and focus on that from a government perspective.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will touch more on that point that you just raised, the Caribbean identity and seeing more of writers in shows, television series, etc. That's a very fascinating point. We will be right back. Stay tuned. This is The Human Impact. So welcome back, TNT. If you have any questions for Ms. Taylor in terms of writing, any young writers or aspiring writers listening to the conversation and you would like some, you know, answers to your pertinent questions, you can send them to 306-1065. And of course, we'll try and take some phone calls within the space as well at 627-3223, 625-2257. And of course, 306-1065, that is the WhatsApp number. So just going back to the Caribbean experience as it pertains to culture and arts, we understand that in a way writers are a bit of our historians and keepers of identity, and there's been a move to introduce or to be more inclusive of cultures around the world. There's been a move for more Native Native American culture within television shows. There is the Maori people who make a strong representation for themselves as well. In terms of the Caribbean, how can writers make sure or be more vocal in placing their identities within the works that you just talked about, television, shows, and more stories to come out?
Yes. So again, a great question. I think for me, speaking from my perspective, I'm a Black person living in Jamaica, so I'm writing about my society. I am going to be reflected, and I'm also going to reflect the other ethnicities who are part of my Jamaican society. It's natural because that's what I see around me, and that's what I'm going to reflect on the page. And you hit on something that's so very important to me, which is one of the reasons why I write. I don't just write because I enjoy it and I want to tell a good story. I think it's very important that we document what our societies were like, what we believed in, what we loved, what we feared, who we were, so that 100 years from now, 200 years from now, where everybody currently alive is dead, other generations can pick it up and read and say, oh, this is who they were. They lived. They mattered. Because, for example, in the Jamaican context, when we think of the Native people, the Tainos, there are none of them left, literally none of them left. And in they were wiped out by the Spanish. There was a brief period of interaction between them and the African, enslaved Africans who were here, you know, on the plantation, but they died. So what I've tried to do, for example, in my book, I have scenes where the characters are eating bami. Bami is a pressed cassava meal that Tainos used to make. That's one of the only things remaining of them. So I feature that in the book because I want people to know that they were here, they lived, because they could not write their own story of conquest, right? The history is written by the persons who conquered them.
Yeah.
So if they had the ability to write and to put their thing down. I'm thinking, how remarkable would that Taino story have been? But it was never preserved. Their history was never preserved. So I'm not a historian, but I believe my job as a writer in the Caribbean, my duty is to ensure that people like that are not forgotten. There's a Ligani Club, which is a place in Jamaica. Ligani is a Taino name. So I give a little history about that part of it as well. So I see it as a writer, my obligation to make sure that the people of the place that I'm from, that they're captured and that they're not forgotten.
What other themes do you think Caribbean writers should tackle? And do you think that they don't tackle these things because it just might be a little difficult to digest?
Well, I think a writer has to write what is what. First of all, that they themselves are passionate about or what they have been through. You know, so if there is domestic violence, it's something they see around them. I first, when I'm writing, I'm not writing for theme per se. I'm writing first to tell the character's story in a compelling way, to render it as authentically as I can. And that's my first thing that I do as a writer. Then afterward, in the editing and looking back, then I see the different themes evolve. But what I write about are the things, again, the issues that are happening in Jamaica society. Single parent homes headed mainly by mothers. Parents leaving their children behind for greener pastures overseas. And the dislocation that that means for the family unit, even as they're trying to better the family. I mentioned domestic violence as well, crime, political violence, issues that are always pertinent, no matter, you know, for me, again, where in the Caribbean you are, you can relate to those kinds of themes. And I feel like as a writer now and speaking, giving advice to other emerging writers, you have to write what you are passionate about, the social issues that you think are that matter, pollution, climate change, discrimination, whatever it is that you feel most passionate about, that's a sign that you should be writing about those things. It's part of your duty to, as a writer, I think, hold up a mirror to the society that you live in, to point out things that they may take for granted or are not really pay attention to, but which you believe is significant.
And best advice you could give to writers now, I know you gave a bit of your perspective from your process in terms of going out there and, as they say, marketing your book. Any advice for them?
That's another brilliant question, because for me, I don't think I'm great at marketing. Naturally an introvert. I am much more comfortable in smaller groups and in my own company than being an extroverted person. So even in this interview, I'm coming out of my shell, you know. But I do believe writers, you already have your social networks. You have people in your family, you have people at work, your clubs you belong to, places you've worked, places you've studied. So what I did was more that sort of one-to-one. So I'm traditionally published, so my publishing house would have a marketing department, a marketing team. So they would reach out to, you know, their usual channels. But for me, I didn't just think I should leave marketing my book to them, but I'm more one-on-one. So I'd reach out to, let's say, UA Alumni Association for them to put it on their mail list. So I reach out to magazines that I would have won an award or been shortlisted, ask them to send it out to their list. So reaching out to persons who I have some connection with and telling them, hey, this book has come out, could you help me spread the word? And so we don't have to necessarily think of this huge, big thing. You can, as a writer, start a list of, okay, what are the people who are in my, who are the people in my circle who have other networks, who have mailing lists, who have other things? Tell them about my book. Fellow writers, for me, I got blurbs from amazing writers in the Caribbean, especially, you know, Trinidad, Claire Adams, Celeste Mojave, generous people who, you know, gave me a few sentences I could put on my book to say, hey, they liked it, basically. And then the fans of those writers would say, oh, if my writer says this is good, I'm going to check it out, you know. So social media is very big. I'm not really that active on it. However, it's the way forward now in terms of reaching people, you know, book talk and Instagram and all of that. So go to the University of Google and sort of educate yourself about what the avenues are, but do what is true for you, what's authentic for you, that you can be consistent in. That's what I'd advise them.
So let's go back a little bit to the conversation where we talked about translating Caribbean writers, local writers, to be seen on screen, moving the from book to screen play, then to on the screen. Tell us a little bit more about that process and how can different stakeholders get involved in that process?
Okay, so typically it starts with the book. So I'm thinking, for example, of Charmaine Wilkinson's book, Black Cake, which was made into a TV series recently. So it typically would go that you write the book, you can get a agent for your film rights. So you as a writer have rights. One of the rights you retain or can also license is the right to adapt your book into a screenplay or film or TV series. So typically you have an agent who would then reach out to different production houses. So typically, let's say in the US or England, they'd reach out to them and say, hey, my author has written this book. We think it's a great book to be made into a movie or a TV series. And if the production house is interested, then they would reach out and pay for the rights to convert it into a movie or a TV series. Now, it tends to mainly happen in the English or American space, or maybe Canadian, but I don't really think in the Caribbean region we have a lot of production houses. We have people who make films, but they're plagued with the same issue of sometimes limited invest, can only do really small films because they just don't have the capital. So again, that's where I think in the region there is a gap where we should invest in, first of all, places to teach people how to make films, how to adapt a book into a script. There's untapped potential there that I think, again, in the region we could do more of.
Now, the discussion has been bandied about for a little while now about making the Caribbean the movie capital of North America, seeing as, you know, we have such luscious beaches and fantastic locations. Is it that we probably need to create more content and actually show them how these things can look? I think the last set that was used in a major movie was Pirates of the Caribbean. I think it was St. Vincent. And the set still kind of existing in the on the beach. You know, I'm wondering if it is lack of knowledge of individuals in the Caribbean saying, because they don't know much of what work is already being done, that more attention is not going there. How can we change the tide to make this space more user-friendly for those who want to create movies and content?
And I think that's a multi-billion dollar question, because we do have in the Caribbean, let's say American movies or whatever, they come and they film particular scenes here or the part of the scenes here, but we're not getting obviously the full gamut in terms of the return, if as opposed to making the film only here. And I'm thinking of, you know, movies like back in the day in Jamaica, which featured the Bobson team, Cool Runnings, and all those other things like Hustle Got Our Groove Back, you know. But I think it starts again with the political will, and also for the organizations that support the arts to also see that as something that they have to bring to the forefront. Writers now are getting more support, but I'm not sure about filmmakers. As a filmmaker, is there a focus from the government or cultural organizations in saying, okay, I'm going to show you how you make a film. You can, here's a school here. Let me bring down an expert from overseas to run sessions to show you how
run
you
a department.
Exactly, like focusing on it. And then after that step, we then have to now come capital. How can I give them grants, fundings? zero income loans or whatever, because the knock-on effect, if you're making a film, you're hiring makeup, you're hiring the clothing people, you're the food, like, is spillover. In the same way with tourism, that every dollar is going to then be magnified because all of the other industries around that, transportation, the hotels, Airbnb, housing, everybody's going to benefit. And eventually tourism too, when people see the film, they're like, oh, I want to go there. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a recognition that it's an untapped resource, and investing in it, like really devoting money out of the budget to say, hey, we're going to train 100 filmmakers in over the next 2 years, Jamaican filmmakers, and equip them. Even if they happen to migrate and go overseas, they're still going to be Caribbean filmmakers. Influence, they're still going to be a part of the you're embedding them in Hollywood or wherever it is, and they're going to be the ones to say, okay, they're working on movies, and the producer, whoever, needs, oh, we need a beat scene. They'll say, oh, let's go Trinidad, or let's go Jamaica, or let's go St. Lucia. Like, you're putting them out in the world. We can export that skill. The same way now, you know, we have a lot of brain drain where a lot of our doctors, nurses, teachers end up in America, England, Canada, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We can export filmmaking talent too, you know, as well. So I think it's really just having the vision to see the potential and taking it from there, and lobbying, you know, people lobbying, media, writers lobbying to say, hey, can you do this, you know, to the government and the powers that be.
And on top of that, to try and understand how, as you said, communities can benefit from such interactions, and what payout would come out to them, because there are many jobs that can be derived from, as I said, the micro industries that are surrounding the industry. And I even went further to think about theme parks. So if it is that, let's say, Cool Runnings was made into a theme park, you know, you have the bobsled.
That would be so cool.
Yeah. You know, they have the what do you call it? The name just ran out of my head, you know, the roller coaster. You know, put those kind of attractions. Exactly. And that could be income generating. And then we've been talking about here in Trinidad, the issue of foreign exchange. And you can see that there are opportunities for those, for that foreign exchange to come in, diversity, you know. So it's an interesting thought. I'm wondering how far, how much further do we have to go to make it a reality? Going to take a short break, and when we come back, let's talk about the future for Miss Taylor and other future books. Yeah, we'll be right back. So TNT, if you're just joining us, you missed out on a very juicy first part of the interview with Miss Sharma Taylor, author, writer from Jamaica, and her latest book. The name is
What a Mother's Love.
What a Mother's Love Don't Teach You. So
and the idea is that there's a scene in which Dinah, the helper who is talking to Apollo, you know, she's using her time they have together to be a mother to him, to try to teach him things, to love on him and all those things. And he's still at that point remaining very selfish and self-focused, and she's like, there's just basically just so far I can go. You know, there's some things a mother's love just can't do. Mm-hmm. You know, can't teach you. You have to decide for yourself the kind of person that you are going to be. Mm-hmm. And that's really where that line stems from.
So, and it's all about, you know, the interactions of a mother's love, interaction with mother and son, and also the separation of countries and cultures. Because as you said, she's a single mother. Her long-lost son, I believe, from the question that you're leaving open for the reader, is if he was or if he wasn't. You know, I'm trying to talk about it without giving away too much.
Exactly. And I've met with several book clubs who are, you know, half of the book club is like, yes, is her son, and other half is, you're crazy. No, he's not. So, and there's just clues that support the arguments deliberately.
So going from writing this book and stepping into another season of gathering ideas for the next one, tell us a little bit about that process, and do you have a new one coming out?
Well, yes. When I sole rights of this book. It was a 2-book deal to Virago. So I'm working on a second novel now. It's set in the 90s and involves, again, a mother. This time, her adopted son commits an unspeakable act and how she has to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's supposed to be the second one. I'm editing it. I've been editing it for some time. But in the pipeline, I have ideas for many, many more books that I really want to ensure I get out. The challenge is, you know, life, day job. You know, as I said, mm-hmm. I'm a corporate lawyer, family commitment. So, but I do hope to finish the editing process this year, send it to the publisher, and hopefully in another 18 months, if it's accepted, it will come out.
Mm-hmm.
But people can say, I mean, I'm not really much on social media. On X, I am Sharma Taylor. I'm on regular email at sharma.taylor@gmail.com. So people can keep up with me, and I'm also on Facebook. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I want to do more teaching as well. I did a term at the university in Abdulwesin is in Mona as a writer in residence, teaching a course in creative writing. Like, I love young people.
Mm-hmm.
I love talking to young people, and people want to be writers and encouraging them. One of my past students from St. Lucia, Jessie, is now shortlisted for the Commonwealth Short Story Prize this year.
Oh, congrats.
And her story is actually the story that was done in my class as a response to a writing prompt. And another student was longlisted, and another person who's done a workshop with me is also shortlisted for the Commonwealth this year too. So I love seeing emerging writers succeed and do their best. And so opportunities to do that and to lecture part-time, those are things that really fuel my joy.
So let me ask you a tickling question now. Would there ever be a time the thought crosses your mind to leave corporate law altogether and just, you know, focus on writing?
Yeah, it's a good thing my boss not listening to this.
No, we don't want to get you in trouble, but, you know.
No, but I think it's pretty clear. For me, anyway, my writing is my passion. It's my first love. So that's something, if I had opportunities to do full-time, I would definitely do.
Mm-hmm.
I do know, though, that a lot of writers, they can't write full-time. That's why you see a lot of them are lecturers as well. You know, they teach part-time to fund their expenses. So
mm-hmm.
That would be the dream. And I'll see how that can happen. One of the thoughts I've had is, you know, set up a little business that can fuel itself so I can write. So that's something maybe mm-hmm. after retirement, who knows, or before, I'll be working on. So that's definitely something that I've been thinking about.
Well, from that answer, I realized that you do love corporate law, and it will be something very different.
You're trying to save my job. I appreciate that.
Ms. Taylor, it was a pleasure speaking with you. And any closing remarks, last, you know, touches of advice for any writer listening right now?
Yes. So first of all, let me say a huge thank you to you. It has been a pleasure speaking with you, a joy, a great start to my day. And thank you very much. Happy to come back anytime.
Not a problem.
And my closing advice would be to writers to trust yourself. You have something to say. You have a voice. Don't feel like you have to write to sound like, you know, the writers you admire. I love Camila, and I used to write trying to sound like him. He's a Jamaican writer. And, you know, one of my writing teachers like, I don't like this. And I said, but why? It sounds just like Camila. She said, that's the point. Write like Sharma, write like yourself. Mm-hmm. So you have your unique voice. Lean into it. Don't be afraid to let your voice be heard. Make sure, which is something you're passionate about, and hone your craft. You know, make the most of opportunities that are there. In Trinidad, you have Bocas. They're always running workshops. If you're serious about your writing, invest in doing those workshops. Invest in learning about it as much as you can, going on YouTube. You know, you don't have to do an MFA, a master's in fine art. I didn't do any MFA or anything like that. But once you are a passionate reader, you're honing your craft, you're devoting yourself to writing, it will happen for you. And success looks different for everybody. Success may not be winning all the awards, selling millions of copies. Success may just be producing a book, holding it in your hand, and knowing that, hey, I've said what I had to say, and there are going to be readers out there who are going to find this book, and it's going to speak to something inside them.
And it's all about connections.
Exactly.
Well, Miss Taylor, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we will talk again soon.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.